You're listening to a Hebrew in Israel podcast with Yoel Halevi, exploring the language, culture, and history of the Bible. For more information, visit us at HebrewInIsrael.net.
Shalom everyone, Yoel here again with another episode of Tzohar LaMikra. And this week we are in Parashat Va'etchanan. Va'etchanan in the sense of to request, to beg. Moses basically turns around to God and begs for forgiveness so he'd be able to enter the land. And obviously, as we all know, he's rejected. And it's a very interesting parasha. There are a lot of interesting points here to speak about. And I actually want to speak revolving around a very specific thing here that actually seems to be a theme in this week's reading. And it seems to be that this parasha really deals a lot with the issue of loyalty. As I mentioned last time, there's the connection between what we have here in Deuteronomy and other documents from the ancient Near East. And what we find here is that we actually have several declarations of faith. And a lot of scholars have discussions about this, about the book of Deuteronomy when it comes to monotheism. And what does Deuteronomy actually say about God? And does it really say it's monotheistic and so on? And it's a well-known discussion, at least for those who are involved in this subject. You know, does the Torah actually reject the existence of other deities? Or is it actually just saying, you know, oh, you as Israel are only allowed to worship one God, and whatever goes on with the rest of the nations is none of your business. And it's an interesting thing because there are several statements which appear in some places that make it seem to be that there are other powers in existence. But again, one of the problems that we have is that the Torah doesn't give us a well-organized way of presenting theology. It tells us, this is your relationship with your creator. This is your relationship with the God that brought you out of Egypt. Whatever the other nations do is none of your business. Don't really care about it. The development of monotheism is a very detailed discussion, probably one of the biggest discussions that exist in the academic world. What is the original faith of Israel? What do they actually believe? And so on. I personally think that, obviously, my opinion would be that Torah begins from monotheism and ends with monotheism. But the question that I have, the question I raise about this, and I'm not the first one to do this, is what exactly defines something as monotheistic? How do you define monotheism in the way the Torah describes it? And a very common thing that people claim is that monotheism automatically means that you believe that God has no form. Okay, monotheism basically says there's only one God. Okay, that's a very, very clear idea. However, a debate that kept on going on in Judaism until, I'm going to say, maybe the 13th, 14th century, is, does God actually have a form? Can you say that God looks like anything? Now, it might be very bizarre for a lot of people for me to bring up this question, but I think that it's just an interesting discussion. And there are basically two ways of reading one of the verses that we, actually some of the verses we have here. And basically Moses says to the people in chapter 4, says, "V'nishmartem me'od lenafshotichem," and you'll be very careful to yourselves, because nefesh can mean just a person. So be very careful. Ki lo ra'item kol tumunah, for you have not seen any image. Beyom diber Adonai elechem b'chorev mitoch ha'esh. On the day that the Lord spoke to you from Chorev, which is another name for Mount Sinai, from the fire. It says, pen tashchiton, that you might destroy, might behave in a disastrous way. V'astem lechem pesel tumunat kol samen, and you make for yourself a statue, an image, any symbol, any form. Tavnit zachar o nekeva, the form of a male or female. And he goes on and on. He mentions birds and creatures that walk on the ground and so on. And the question is, why does Moses go into, there's several questions here. First of all, why does Moses go into male, female, and then also different kinds of animals and so on? So I think the answer here is very simple, that he's saying, don't even, besides the imagery of a human being, okay, besides the practice that exists in the ancient world to represent gods in the form of a human being, and gods, and even the Tanakh attributes a lot of human aspects, a lot of human attributes to God, and that's another question. We'll deal with that in a second. But also, don't try to represent God through any form of animal. Now, there are basically two ways of reading this verse. One way will argue that God has no form whatsoever. He says, you didn't see anything, therefore there was nothing there, there was no form that you would see. Another opinion claims, again, both of them actually fit into this verse, another opinion claims that, no, it doesn't mean that God has no form, it's that you didn't see any form. In other words, there was smoke, and there was mist, and you couldn't see anything, but there was something inside the clouds that God actually did ascend, and there is some kind of a form that exists. How exactly you define this type of form, and so on. So there's a discussion in regards to what does it mean, don't make a form of God. And the discussion really goes around the idea that the Tanakh is not necessarily saying God has no form. It's that you as a person, if you make a form of God, if you claim that you are able to make an image of God, you have a comprehension of who God is. The idea that if you can recognize someone by their physical form, it gives you some kind of a comprehension of who they are. And God clearly states, you can't comprehend me. This is one of the ideas that we find in the book of Job, that we as human beings have no comprehension of who God is. The subject of the human attributes that people give to God, obviously, at least to me, seems to be something that really has to do with human beings trying to relate to God as close as they can. We as human beings have a tendency to need something tangible and need something that we can recognize so we can actually say, oh, okay, this is something that I can work with. Because if I tell you something completely abstract, then you're going to sit there or something that we as humans don't understand or don't see or whatever it might be, something that doesn't really fit into the world that we live in, then we'll have a lot of difficulty relating to any of it. Now, so the Torah basically goes into this idea that, and this is my opinion at least, that God either has or doesn't have a form. This is not really the discussion. It's really in the idea of you can't comprehend God, and therefore it would be disrespectful to try to say, oh, I know what God looks like, and therefore I can make an image of Him, and I can actually say this is what He looks like. Now, there is a debate that did people actually think that their gods looked exactly like the way they depicted them? And the answer is not necessarily. They were really trying just to give some kind of a representation. So the whole subject of exactly what did people who worshipped idols, even if they say believed in only one God, what did these people believe that the image represented is a very interesting debate that's very, very difficult for us to actually crack, because these ideas have been lost throughout the centuries, and the only groups that we have left that actually worship actual images don't necessarily belong to the same world that they did back then. However, I did once have a discussion with someone who's an expert in Hinduism. And when I asked him about the whole imagery in Hinduism, and I asked him, you know, as one of the very few cultures that are accessible, that actually worship idols, how do they perceive the idol? How do they see the idol? And the answer was that the image means absolutely nothing. That they didn't believe that the deity dwells in the image or whatever it might be. Though we do know that in the ancient Near East, people did believe that there was some kind of presence of the deity. But what he basically told me was that they perceive and only they perceive that the god is there, and then it takes meaning. That they actually understand that the statue means absolutely nothing, that the image, the painting, whatever it may be, that they have in front of them means absolutely nothing until a human being has intent for it to have meaning. And this is a very, very interesting element, because basically what it demonstrates is that a lot of religions basically feel as if they have the power over God, that they have some kind of ability to bind God into something. And this is something the Torah is basically telling you can't do. That's why the Torah kind of limits the amount of description of God. It allows attributes of human attributes, because we have to have something we can relate to. However, it doesn't allow you to bind God into anything, not in word and not in image, because by trying to bind God, it gives a certain element of thinking that you control God. And that was one of the ideas they used to have back then. On one hand, you fear the God, you fear the deity, because that deity has a lot of power. But then on the other hand, you have some kind of control over the deity by saying, oh, you are bound to, you're the God of the city of Lagesh, or you're the God of the city of Uruk, or whatever city it might be. Same thing with Jerusalem. The temple in Jerusalem, God basically said, I don't have to dwell here. I choose to dwell here, or to put some kind of a presence of myself here, because you asked me to do so. But at the end of the day, if I decide that you no longer respect me, you no longer represent who I am, I reserve the right to get up and leave. So even in the Temple of Jerusalem, God said, you can't bind me into one place. I am free to roam in whatever way I want. And this is something that was very different than the ancient Near East. So when you go into the discussion of how did the Israelites perceive God and how they saw God in their call it quote-unquote theology, it was different than the rest of the people. So how did they actually perceive monotheism? They believed in one God. And it seems to be very clear that they believed in one God that is free, that he can't do anything to him, you can't bound him, which also goes in the whole question of witchcraft. Because one of the ideas of witchcraft is that you have the ability to harness powers. This is one of the ideas of what Bilam was trying to do, that he was a sorcerer. He thought that he'd be able to bound God into a situation where he can manipulate things. And God basically says, there's no way for that to happen. So the one of the things that we do learn is that God is a very free, unbound, and transcendent being, which is very, very different than what some people try to claim that the Israelites believed. And I think, and this seems to be what the Tanakh is saying, and it seems to be that really this is the answer why we do find certain elements of paganism in artifacts that we find from the First Temple period. It's because there was a regression. It's very difficult to fight against popular thought. The majority of people around the Israelites believed in different things, believed in very problematic things. And at the end of the day, because it's so popular, it becomes a very common, it starts influencing what people believe in. But it still doesn't change the question of, does God actually have a form? And at the end of the day, it's anyone's guess. Does he have a form? He doesn't have a form. When he comes down to earth, is this a metaphor or is this something which is more literal? And there's a debate about this. In some places, the Torah avoids using such language. In other places, it has to use this type of language because it tries to at least give you some kind of a connection, something you can comprehend as a person. So some questions of monotheism. Another question of monotheism actually comes with some declarations of faith that we have in this parasha. For example, we have the Ten Commandments, one of the versions of the Ten Commandments, which is still, the differences are not great, but the Ten Commandments appear here as well, together with the Shema, what we have in Deuteronomy 6. And it's very interesting how the Ten Commandments open, because it says, Anochi Adonai Elohecha, Asher Otzeticha Meretz Yitzrayim Bet Avadim, I am the Lord thy God, or your God, who bore you out of Egypt from the house of bondage, or the house of slaves. And God basically says, your relationship with me has to do with this. There's the covenant of Abraham, there's the covenant of Isaac, covenant of Jacob, and so on, covenant with Noah, covenant with man. But our relationship begins from the concept of I brought you out of Egypt. And this is something that's repeated over and over and over again in Jewish liturgy, throughout the Tanakh, and so on, that the pivotal point where the people of Israel, not the ancestors, the people of Israel came into a covenant with the God of Israel has to do specifically with the Exodus and nothing before that, which brings into a lot of discussions about, for example, the book of the Kuzari, which is it's really a philosophical discussion spinning off of something that happened around the 12th century with some group that the Kuzari kingdom, that someone in that kingdom converted. Now, there's some people who misuse this information. I've studied this material also as part of my degree, and it's very clear that it was really the elite that converted, and the rest of the people just went on with their lives. It was a very common thing that the elite of a society would convert. The same thing happened with the Edomites. It was the elite. It was more, if with the Edomites, for example, it was more of a financial thing. They were anyhow one foot in. The whole idea that Judah the Maccabee forced converted the Edomites is very, very questionable. And the same thing with the Khazaris. It seems to be that the elite converted for some reason, maybe as part of the struggle against the spread of Christianity. They realized that they can't struggle with Christianity in the same way that they were able to do it with their own religion. So they converted to Judaism, which gave them tools to struggle with the spread of Christianity, with the influence it had on people, some kind of an alternative. Also, it's quite possible some of them were convinced by the truth of Torah and the truth of Judaism, but even their conversion, I mean, from what I read about this material about them, they didn't really convert to Judaism. They did something, a hybrid in between, with practicing Torah but with some elements of Judaism. It's not really clear. There's even an argument that maybe some of them kind of went on a kind of a Karaite way of doing things. It's not too clear what happened with them. But it's very interesting that the same argument is actually presented by the writer of the book, Rabbi Yehuda Levi. We have no relation, though part of my family did come from Spain, but as far as I know, we're not related. It's also been, you know, 900 years or something, so it doesn't really, or 800 years, so it doesn't really work. I can't really prove a relation, but in any case, he starts the argument from the same place, and he says the reason we say from the Exodus is because this is something that happened in front of everyone, and it's you weren't there when the world was created, and Abraham was an individual, Isaac was an individual, and Jacob was an individual, but here it's a covenant also with an entire nation. So this is the point when we became a people. So it's interesting that the Ten Commandments were placed as part of the liturgy that people would use in everyday life, and it was removed at one point because of certain people that argued, oh, only this was given to Moses, this was the only words that God actually said. And Ten Commandments have always been a list of statements that are used by all the time by, I would say, different groups as kind of like the only real statement of God, the only real part of the Torah that we need to consider. And we know that, for example, in 2nd, 3rd centuries, there were groups that said, we only follow the Ten Commandments. It's a very common thing that sometimes you hear from secular people. They say, oh, I'm willing to follow the Ten Commandments. And then you ask them, so what about the Sabbath? Do you actually keep the Sabbath? And they kind of realize they don't really know what the Ten Commandments are actually saying. Excuse me. And they're really relating more to the second half of the Ten Commandments, where you shall not do this and so on. But it's very interesting that this was used as a declaration of faith. So in this parasha, we actually have two declarations of faith. One is the Ten Commandments, which are the base core idea of what it means that we believe in God, that we have some kind of a covenant with God. And this kind of sums up everything. He brought us out of Egypt. We are supposed to only worship Him. We're not supposed to take His name in vain, and so on. This is like a basic core covenant that we have with God, and then everything else is, actually, some even argue this, everything else is kind of an offshoot of the Ten Commandments. And the Ten Commandments obviously divide up into our relationship with the divine, and then also our relationship with one another. Basically saying that our covenant with God is also our covenant with one another. That the Torah is not just limited to the idea of you're worshiping a God, which is something that was very, very common in ancient Near East. The Torah is actually saying your covenant with God is also bound to the fact that God created mankind and wants mankind to exist and wants mankind to live and care for one another. And this is where the Torah binds the covenant not only to the divine element, but also to the human element. You want to be in covenant with God, you also have to be in covenant with one another. And this is why I strongly denounce attacks that people have against one another. You can have criticism. You can have criticism of someone's action. Someone does something, you think it's wrong, you contact them, you tell them, listen, you're wrong. That is to be in a covenant with one another. But to think that every time that someone does something, you have to be vicious or attack them and be ferocious about it, it's not always true. There's a question, why was Elijah taken away? Why was Elijah taken up to the heavens? And the Midrash actually gives a really, really reasonable answer. And the answer it gives is because Elijah behaved in a manner that didn't fit the covenant between people, that he didn't fit the generation, that you can't always violently hit people over the head because you disagree with their actions. There's no doubt that people sin. There's no doubt that there are mistakes. There's no doubt there's mistakes in Judaism. There's no doubt there's mistakes in charism. There's no doubt mistake in whatever group that you have, people who follow Torah come from other places, messianics and so on. Everyone has a mistake somewhere. Everyone has some kind of an idea that's wrong. And what we need to do is work together. The same way the Ten Commandments are all together, mixing together God and man in one place as part of the base stipulations of Torah, we have to understand that this is what we have to do with one another. That it's not enough to say God is one and then bash everyone over the head. It's God is one and his people are one. And if we are commanded to love God, as it says in the Shema, which is the other declaration of faith. If the Torah says that we are supposed to love God, it says, "Ve'ahavta et Adonai Elohecha b'chol levavcha v'chol nafshecha v'chol me'odecha." If God commanded us to love one another, okay, we have to love one another. He says you need to love God. It says, "Ve'ahavta," from the word "ahav," to love. He commands us to love him. Love is also part of a covenant language, but it means to be devoted, to be monotheistic, to believe that he is your only ruler, that he is the only governor that you have above you. If he commands you to love him, it means you need to love him unconditionally. And if you love him unconditionally, you do everything that he says. And one of the things that he tells you to do is "Ve'ahavta le're'acha kamocha." To love thy neighbor as yourself. If you viciously attack someone because they misunderstand something, that is not the fulfillment of that commandment. And maybe, and this I'm throwing this as a maybe, to some degree, you're breaking Torah by doing that. If you see someone that goes and worships an idol, someone who deliberately, deliberately is rebelling, as a system is deliberately rebelling against God, that's when you pull out your stick and start hitting that person over the head. But if someone is interested in keeping the covenant, no matter where they're from, but if someone is interested in keeping the covenant, and you know that they're making a mistake, but their intention is not to break Torah, the intention is to keep Torah, they just have a misunderstanding, then you need to turn around to them and explain it. Not to run and start viciously attacking them and say, you're in sin or whatever it might be. That is not keeping the covenant. There are times when you have to be tough and there are times when you have to be soft, as it says in Kohelet. Okay? So it's a very, very important thing, something most of us forget. And I'm saying this because specifically something has come up lately with some discussions that I've had with different people and things that people post on Facebook, for example. The internet is wonderful, but on the other hand, it allows people to say a lot of weird things without necessarily taking responsibility. It's easy to leave a post. It's easy to make a claim somewhere and just vanish suddenly or not respond to it after someone debunks you or rebukes you or whatever it might be. So it's very important that we need to remember that when God gave us the Torah, the intention was not just to have a covenant with him directly, but also have a covenant with one another. The Torah is built from two sections. I am the Lord thy God, or Shema Yisrael Adonai Eloheinu Adonai Echad. Okay, two different verses, one in Hebrew, one in English. And also, Ve'ahavta le're'acha kamocha. To love your neighbor as yourself, to love your friend as yourself. A re'a is not just a neighbor. A re'a really means someone who is your relative, someone who is your friend. And yes, there are sinners, but you need to remember that there's a balance. People are very quick to judge. People behave as if they are the judge. And this is not necessarily right. Not in every situation do you have to sound as if you're zealous to God. Sometimes being soft is the way to do it as well. If you discover the person is deliberately rebelling, that's already something else. In any case, that's the second message. The third message I have is not really a message, it's more of a question. It's like people always have these discussions about how to translate the Shema. And the truth is there are basically four different translations that I know that exist, which depend on different ways of understanding the grammar of the Shema. So first of all, Shema Yisrael is obviously an opening declaration. So it's to attract your attention. And really, the declaration itself is Adonai Eloheinu Adonai Echad. And there are different ways of reading this. Some people say that what it actually means is that these are two different statements. It's one, for example, one interpretation says, Adonai hu Eloheinu, Adonai hu Echad. The Lord is our God, the Lord is one. Okay? Another one says, Adonai hu Eloheinu, Adonai Echad, Echad in the sense of the only one, in the sense of the Lord is our God, the Lord alone. He's the only one who is our God. Some people see it as one long statement, which really translates the same way, but again, there's a grammatical idea here. And some people say, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Hu Echad, the Lord, our God, this Lord that we've just mentioned, expanding the translation, He is one. That really, that this is what we call an emphatic clause, where the Lord, our God, He is one. Okay, the Lord, He is one. So there are subtleties between these different translations, but each one of them kind of plays around with a different thing. On the one hand, if I say the Lord is one, there's only one, I'm basically making a very clear monotheistic statement where I'm saying there's only one God. On the other hand, if I say the Lord alone can, if I say levad, levado, if I translate the word alone, it gives more of a sense of this is our covenant with Him. Whatever's out there is irrelevant to us. And there are different ways of understanding the grammar here. There are different opinions. There's discussions about the type of language that Deuteronomy uses and so on. This is actually something a bit too complex to explain on a recording like this. It's more something that needs to be maybe dealt with on a separate recording. But there are types of styles of language which are considered to be fitting to the book of Deuteronomy. And then there's types of language which are not considered to be fitting to Deuteronomy. And at the end of the day, statements like this, I mean, can be read in different ways. But I think that if we stick at least to the concept that we say that we as Israel, as the Torah keepers, have a covenant with the God of Israel, and we only worship Him, we're only in contact with Him, I think that's sufficient, because it doesn't matter what are the exact theological ideas the Torah tries to present. The main point is that we have a covenant with God. And I think that's one of the reasons why the Torah doesn't go too deep into these theological discussions of the nature of God and who God is and how many gods might be and so on, because it doesn't care about that. What it says is that you have a covenant with the God of Israel. Later on, in the prophets, especially in the book of Isaiah, we start seeing a much, much stronger monotheistic God, only the God of Israel exists and so on. But it's very interesting that the Torah doesn't really go into that. And there are different ideas why that happens. In any case, I hope you enjoyed this recording. I hope it opened up some discussions that you can continue with yourself or maybe with me even on Facebook, Hebrew in Israel, or my email, HebrewInIsrael1word@gmail.com. As usual, I also offer Hebrew lessons, a Bible class that I have every Sunday. And I want to wish everyone a Shabbat Shalom, and I hope you enjoyed this recording.